I don't have my watch, so I'm going to get my phone out here so I can keep an eye on the time. This is the closest that we've ever gone to the feast, and I think we forgot more things this year than ever before, too. Forgot clothes and my watch and razor, and I don't remember what else, but forgot a lot of stuff, but still been a good feast. I wanted to start out with a question that we often ask, which is, why are we here? What are we doing here? Why are you here? Why are you sitting here this morning? What's this week all about? We know that some of the things that we're here to learn about are potential, the future. We're here to catch the vision, to be motivated. We're here to experience a taste of the millennium. But we're also here to learn about what we can work on now and what we should be doing now in our life. Let's turn over to Revelation chapter 5. Revelation chapter 5, and down in verse 10 of Revelation 5, says, "Has made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth." So we know that's our potential future. Over in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 6, Revelation chapter 20 and verse 6 says the same thing. Revelation 20 verse 6, "Blessed and holy is he that has part in the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power. But they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So that's that future, reigning, kings, priests. That's the goal. But if that's the goal, how do we get there? What do we do now to accomplish that goal? What should we be doing? Should we be going to engineering school if we're going to be kings and priests and rulers? Should we become an architect or a city planner or a plumber? You know, cities need lots of plumbing. Is that what we should be doing? Technical skills by themselves are fine. It's good to have knowledge like that. We've been doing some remodeling on our house and have been learning some fun technical skills. But ultimately, it's all going to be worthless. All of those technical skills are going to be worthless. That's not the thing of true value. There's really only one thing that we absolutely must develop. And that sounds simple. It's one thing. But it's the most difficult thing that anyone could ever develop, and that's character. It's not about how much knowledge we have, technical skills. The only thing that really matters is character. And as you build true character, you'll develop a lot of other skills along the way, because there are so many things that go along with character. You can't just sit still and kind of stagnate and build character. You're going to be active, and you're going to be out there doing things. So you'll be building other skills that are extremely useful in life, but that's not the critical element that will determine your future. To get to that goal here that we just read briefly in Revelation 5 and in Revelation chapter 20, we have to build character, character to rule, character to reign, character to lead. So that's what I want to talk about today, is some things that we can be doing now, that we can be working on now, so that we can be developing that one thing that really matters, really the only thing. And Mr. Bedloe had 5 points. I wanted to have more than he did. So I went for 12, which is probably a little ambitious. We might not get through all of them. But I called them 12 rules for rulers. So these are rules for rulers. And that's what we are supposed to be learning how to become. We're supposed to be learning how to rule. And so we're going to go through some rules today for rulers. The first rule is to learn and practice government now. If you want to develop some talent, some skill, you can't just go out there and do it immediately. If you want to play the piano, if you want to play a sport, you can't just go out there and play at a high level immediately. You have to learn and you have to practice and you have to do it over and over and over again. And then eventually you get to the point where you have that skill. There's some study that's been done, actually several studies, and kind of the common assessment is that it takes about 10,000 hours of doing something to become at an expert level of proficiency in it. 10,000 hours. That's a lot of time. If you work a job full-time for a year, that's about 2,000 man-hours. So if you think about trying to get to that expert level of proficiency, it's basically like you were working full-time at it for 5 years. So how much time do we put into learning about government, practicing it in our homes, in the church? You know, it's something that there's a lot of opportunity to do it. Do we just let that slide by, or do we actually take those opportunities and put it into practice? Let's turn over to Deuteronomy. One of the things that we can do is we can study the law of the government, study the code that we'll be administering. Over in Deuteronomy chapter 17, at the end of this chapter, in Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 18, there's a simple admonition here that's given to the people who would become rulers of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 17 and verse 18. It shall be when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests, the Levites. And it shall be with him, and he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them. So it's something the king is going to study this law. He's going to write out a whole copy for himself. He's going to study it. He's going to study it every day. He's going to be practicing it every day, putting that time into it so that he can be an expert in it. He can administer it properly and effectively. Verse 20, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he turn not aside from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. So the kings were directed to really learn the law, learn how the government was supposed to work, and learn what they were supposed to be administering. And that's something that we can do as future kings. But right now, you know, most of us are not kings. Most of us are not presidents or mayors or anything like that. We are under authority. We're under a civil government. And we can learn how to behave in that kind of environment as well. Let's go back to Exodus chapter 22. We have to remember that God has put world leaders into their positions. Daniel said that when he was interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream. He talked about how he knew that God had put him in that position of leadership as the world ruler. And God is able to determine who's going to be the next president of the United States, who's going to be prime minister in England, what's going to happen in China and Japan and anywhere in the world that he needs something to happen, he's going to make it happen. But we have a responsibility to live as peaceful citizens, as productive citizens, and, you know, to follow the laws of the land as long as they don't conflict with God's laws. Over in Exodus chapter 22 and verse 28, there's a statute here that says, "You shall not revile the gods," and that's actually Elohim, so it just the word that's translated God throughout Genesis chapter 1. "You shall not revile God, nor curse the ruler of your people." And over in Acts 23, if we flip over there quickly, we'll see that Paul refers back to this. Acts chapter 23. Acts 23 and verse 1. "And Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God until this day. And the high priest, Ananias, commanded them that stood by him to smite him on the mouth." So the high priest here had told the people who were standing by Paul to slap him on the face. "Then Paul said unto him, God shall smite you, you whited wall, for sit you to judge me after the law and command me to be smitten contrary to the law? And they that stood by said, Revile you God's high priest? Then Paul said, I knew not, brethren, that he was the high priest, for it is written, You shall not speak evil of the ruler of your people." So Paul realized who this was, and he said, oh, I didn't know that, or I wouldn't have responded like that in anger. And so that's something that Paul quotes that verse over in Exodus 22. You know, what's our attitude towards world government? You know, it can get really frustrating, things in this world, and we can get caught up in it. I was talking with someone earlier this week about it. It can end up taking up a lot of our time and dragging us down and making us upset and angry. But all of that is in God's hands, and we need to live as an example, and we need to not get bogged down in things of this world. And, you know, we need to have respect for the police. I got my first 2 speeding tickets ever this year. And, you know, have to be respectful, even though one of the police officers was pretty rude. And he gave me a ticket for having my address wrong on my driver's license, even though it was correct. It was kind of a funny story, but you have to stay respectful, even when things like that happen. So that's part of learning how to deal with government now. And, you know, it's not just in the church, but it's elsewhere. And then over in 1 Timothy, we see one of the areas that we can really be practicing it. 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4. It's talking about the office of a bishop or a minister, a deacon, someone who's ordained, qualifications for them. And in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, it says, "One that rules well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God?" Or you might say, if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he be a king and priest in the kingdom? Now, it's something that there's an area right there where with our families, with our children, with our spouses, or even if we're single, just with ourselves, do we have an orderly house and an orderly life, and is there discipline and control in that environment? It says right here that if we can't get that in order, how are we going to take on bigger responsibilities in the church, in the kingdom, and on out for eternity? That's one of the things that we have to be going and practicing it right now. So the first rule is learn government now, practice it now, so that we can administer it later. Study, take the opportunities that come along in the church and in our family and even in society to set the proper example and have the right attitude and learn how to be in government. Rule number two, learn from previous rulers. And there are lots and lots of rulers that you can learn from. In the Bible, there are lots and lots of kings and priests and judges that you can go through and read about. I just want to turn over to 1 Kings chapter 12. Read one anecdote here. 1 Kings chapter 12. After David died, Solomon, his son, became king over all of Israel. And then Solomon died, and his son became king. And this is kind of the first story just after Rehoboam started to reign in 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 1. "And Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel were come to Shechem to make him king. And it came to pass when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who was yet in Egypt, heard of it, for he was fled from the presence of King Solomon, and Jeroboam dwelt in Egypt, that they sent and called him. And Jeroboam and all the congregation of Israel came and spake unto Rehoboam, saying, Your father made our yoke grievous. Now therefore, make you the grievous service of your father, and his heavy yoke which he put upon us lighter, and we will serve you. And he said unto them, Depart for 3 days, then come again to me. And the people departed." So Solomon had taxed the people a lot, and he had these incredible building projects and public works, and had expanded the kingdom. And here Jeroboam was kind of stirring up the people and saying, well, what are you going to do? Are you going to continue that? Or are you going to lighten it a little bit and not expect so much from us? Verse 6, "And King Rehoboam consulted with the old men that stood before Solomon his father while he yet lived, and said, How do you advise that I may answer this people?" So these were men who had served Solomon, who was a very wise king. Verse 7, "And they spoke unto him, saying, If you will be a servant unto this people this day, and will serve them, and answer them, and speak good words to them, then they will be your servants forever. But he forsook the counsel of the old men which they had given him, and consulted with the young men that were grown up with him and which stood before him. And he said unto them, What counsel give you that we may answer this people who have spoke to me, saying, Make the yoke which your father did put upon us lighter? And the young men that were grown up with him spake unto him, saying, Thus shall you speak unto this people that spake unto you, saying, Your father made our yoke heavy, but make you it lighter unto us. Thus shall you say unto them, My little finger shall be thicker than my father's loins. And now, whereas my father did lade you with a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father has chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions." So Rehoboam listened to his friends and the people that were around him. He didn't go out and listen to the wise counsel of the people who had been there for years and had served Solomon. You know the story. He ended up losing most of the kingdom, and the kingdom split into Israel and Judah and never reunited again after that. But there's a lot to learn from this story here about seeking wise counsel, about how to handle difficult situations. And if you go through the books of Samuel and 1st and 2nd Chronicles and 1st and 2nd Kings, you'll see that there are so many lessons that you can learn. I like to suggest homework sometimes. And one of the things that you can do in a Bible study is you can go through those books and you could go through each king that's listed out for Israel and Judah and write down one lesson that you can learn from each of them. And you could take one a day and write them all down. There were, I think, about 47 total. There was one queen who ruled for 6 years. And you can go through and you can learn from each of them. And it's something that you could do Bible study on for a couple of months. And you'd walk away with some interesting experiences from these previous kings and queens. And you could learn a lot about things that would help you be a leader. A lot of good lessons, but also a lot of bad lessons. Especially once the kingdom splits and you start going through the kings of Israel, a lot of what you learn is what not to do. But that's important to learn as well. So the second rule is take time to learn from previous rulers, from the kings and priests. And you can also look at leaders in other areas, whether it's in the Bible, like the judges or Moses or the apostles, or even leaders like Winston Churchill and others who have been strong leaders in the world. The third rule is develop humility and remove pride. And this one is counter to what a lot of people traditionally think a leader needs to have. You know, they think a leader needs to have confidence and needs to have pride and needs to go out there and be ready to show that they know exactly what needs to be done. But a true leader and a true ruler has to have humility, and they have to remove pride. Let's turn over to Judges chapter 8. Judges chapter 8. After Gideon had gone and had his great triumph and defeated the host of Midian with a very small army with trumpets and torches, down in verse 22 of Judges chapter 8, the people came to him, and in Judges 8:22 we read, "Then the men of Israel said unto Gideon, Rule you over us, both you and your son's son also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian." They came to him and they said, "You did it, Gideon. You did it. You beat them. You defeated them. And we want you to set up a dynasty. We want you to rule over us, and then your children and your grandchildren, and you're going to be our leader." And that's probably something that could be fairly tempting. If somebody comes to you and they say, "We want you to be in charge, and we want your family to be in charge. You're the man. You did it." But look at Gideon's response in verse 23 of Judges 8. "And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." So Gideon, you know, he still had that proper attitude. That was the attitude that he had before they went into the battle, and that was the attitude that he had through the battle, and, you know, he still had that even after he'd been victorious and accomplished this task. You know, it was definitely the right sentiment, but if you read just through the next verses, you'll see that he then went and built a giant golden idol. So, you know, Gideon had issues as well, but he had the right attitude when it came to rulership, and he knew that it wasn't his place to accept this rulership over the people and to say, "Yes, you know, I am going to be the king, and we're going to establish a dynasty." He said, "I will not rule over you, the Lord shall rule over you." So that's a very good example of the kind of attitude that a godly leader and a godly ruler should have. That's the attitude that we'll have to have in the kingdom. It's not going to be, "Yes, you know, I'm going to rule this city and it's all about me." We're still going to be under God and Christ, and we're going to be administering the kingdom of God, not the kingdom of Jonathan or the kingdom of whoever it is that is over a particular city. We have to remember that at the end of the day, God rules over everyone, and we are just a piece in the administration. Let's turn back to Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10. Christ makes this point to his disciples over here in Mark chapter 10 and verse 42. Mark 10:42, "But Jesus called them to him and said unto them, You know that they which are accounted to rule over the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and their great ones exercise authority upon them." And, you know, if you look at some of the quote-unquote great leaders out there, they have all sorts of requirements for how people address them, how people interact with them, and it's all about kind of pumping themselves up and putting themselves on a pedestal. Verse 43, "But so shall it not be among you. But whosoever will be great among you shall be your minister, shall be a servant. And whosoever of you will be the chiefest shall be servant of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. So even Christ, when he came, he didn't come to be served and to be waited on hand and foot. He came to serve, and that's what we have to do. If you are going to go out and serve others, you have to develop humility. If you feel entitled and think that everyone should be serving you, then you're not going to have an attitude that allows you to go out and serve other people. You're not going to be willing to go do things that might not be pleasant, that might not be enjoyable. You aren't going to have that humility. You have to get rid of the pride and develop humility. Let's go back to 2 Samuel. This is another little anecdote from a king, in this case King David. 2 Samuel chapter 7. One of the things that David set his mind on that he really wanted to do was build a temple for God. He said, I live in a house of cedar, and what we have for God is a tent. And that didn't seem right to him, and he wanted to build God a great house. And so Nathan tells him to go ahead and do that, but Nathan spoke too quickly. God appears to Nathan in a vision and has a message for David. We can pick that up here in 2 Samuel chapter 7 and verse 12. He talks about how he made David king, and then he says in 2 Samuel 7, verse 12, and when your days be fulfilled, and you shall sleep with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, which shall proceed out of you, and I will establish his kingdom, and he shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. And he tells David, you know, you don't get to build me a house. Elsewhere he says that he was a bloody man. He fought wars, and he killed a lot of people, and so God was not going to allow David to build him a temple. And if you think about how a lot of buildings get put up, a lot of churches or buildings at universities, someone wants to build a new business administration school on a university, and they'll donate money, they'll help raise money, and then they want their name on there. And it's something that they're doing for the university, but they're also doing for themselves and their legacy. And so David wanted to build this temple. But if you look at his response when God told him no, you see that he wasn't doing this for himself. He wasn't doing this for his legacy. Down in verse 18, then went King David in and sat before the Lord, and he said, who am I, O Lord, and what is my house that you have brought me hitherto? And this was yet a small thing in your sight, O Lord God, but you have spoken also of your servant's house for a great while to come. Is this the manner of man, O Lord God? And what can David say more unto you? For you, Lord God, know your servant. So David was grateful for what God had promised him, and he was fine that he wasn't going to get to build the temple. And he went and he did what he could to make preparations, to make plans, to gather supplies, but he didn't get in a huff and say, oh, well, I want to do it, and I'm going to go do it anyway. He had humility, and he didn't have pride about this. How do we react when we don't get what we want? This was something that David really wanted to do, and God basically said no. But he had a great attitude about it. And he said, thank you for everything that you have done for me and for the promises that you have given me. How do we react? Do we get grouchy and do we go and try to make it work anyway? Whether it's something that we'd like to have physically or something that we've been praying for, an unanswered prayer, we can't get a bad attitude. David didn't get a bad attitude here. He went and did what he could, but he accepted God's answer and, you know, moved on and continued with the rest of his life. So it's a very good example of a practical way that humility is really important. It's really key. David didn't feel entitled and like he had to go build that temple. So that's one of the things that we have to be doing. We have to be developing humility and removing pride. The fourth rule, we have to be motivated, we have to stay motivated, we have to work hard. Let's go over to Nehemiah. We've heard about motivation several times already this feast. We've heard things that should motivate us. We should remember those and keep those in mind so that we can be motivated and stay motivated. And then we act on that motivation with hard work. Over in Nehemiah chapter 3, we're going to just skip through a couple of verses here. They're rebuilding the wall here in Nehemiah chapter 3. One of the things that struck me, though, is who is out working on rebuilding this wall? This is probably not easy work, building a wall, stacking stones. But let's pick it up here in Nehemiah chapter 3 and verse 9. It's listing out everyone who's working on the wall, and it says, "Next unto them repaired Rephaiah the son of Hur, the ruler of the half part of Jerusalem." So this was someone who was basically like, you might say, like an assistant mayor, you know, a councilman, who ruled over half part of Jerusalem. And he's out building the wall. Down in verse 12, "Next unto him repaired Shallum the son of Halahesh, the ruler of the half part of Jerusalem, he and his daughters." So here's the other ruler of the other half of Jerusalem, and he's out there with his daughters working on the wall. Now, our town is pretty small where we live, Edom. It's got about 300 people. We do have a mayor, though. But, you know, when there's a pothole in downtown Edom, you don't see our mayor out there with a shovel filling it in. I'm sure that where you live, the city council members are generally not out fixing water leaks or repairing the sidewalks. It's something that here was manual labor, but it needed to be done. And these rulers were out there with everyone else working on it. They weren't afraid to do the dirty work that needed to be done in this case. And that's something that rulers can think, oh, well, I'm going to sit here in my comfy chair and just direct everyone else. But if you take that attitude too early on or on too many things, then pretty soon you won't have anything to rule over. I've seen that many times in business where we have managers or directors who want to stay above it all and never get into the details. And sooner or later, they're too out of touch with what's going on and they become ineffective and end up losing their position. So it's something where these rulers were not afraid to work hard. They were not afraid to get out there and do what needed to be done to really lead their people. And it was also an example of humility and willingness to go do something that, you know, they could have viewed as beneath them. Let's turn over to Proverbs chapter 6 on this topic of being motivated, working hard. Proverbs chapter 6. Mr. Abasolo wrote an article about this. It was in the magazine. Proverbs chapter 6 and verse 6. "Go to the ant, you sluggard, consider her ways and be wise, which having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provides her meat in the summer and gathers her food in the harvest." So, saying, you know, all of you lazy people, go look at these ants. They don't have someone who's there overseeing them, telling them exactly what to do, but they know what needs to be done and they get it done. Verse 9, "How long will you sleep, O sluggard? When will you arise out of your sleep? Yet a little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to sleep, so shall your poverty come as one that travails, and your want as an armed man." We have to be developing a work ethic, and we have to show God that we're willing to work and to push ourselves and to drive ourselves, because he's got a lot of work in store for us. It's going to be a lot to do, and someone who's lazy, who's not willing to pitch in, that's not what God needs. That's not going to be someone who's useful and productive. And, you know, you shouldn't push yourself to exhaustion and cause yourself health problems, but it's something that if there's work that needs to be done, and that's one of the commands that we have is to work and to be productive, then we need to be developing that work ethic in our lives. Let's go over to Matthew again, read another passage here. Christ touches on this. Matthew chapter 25. Matthew chapter 25. This is the parable of the talents. Just skip through a couple of verses here. We know that there's a man, he had servants, and he gave them talents. And in verse 20, "So he that had received 5 talents came and brought another 5 talents, saying, Lord, you delivered unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. So this man took what he had and doubled it, and had basically gotten 100% out of it. His Lord said unto him, Well done, you good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter you into the joy of your Lord. Verse 22, he also that had received 2 talents came and said, Lord, you delivered unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents beside them. So again, a 100% gain, a 100% improvement. Verse 23, his Lord said unto him, Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Enter you into the joy of your Lord. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew you that you are a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not strawed. and I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the earth. Lo, therefore, you have what is yours. His Lord answered and said unto him, You wicked and slothful or lazy servant, you know that I reap where I sowed not and gather where I have not strawed. You ought therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received my own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him and give it unto him which has 10 talents. So this is a situation where these 3 servants had been given different levels of talent, different amounts, and the first 2 each doubled it, had 100% increase, and the 3rd one didn't do anything with it and just hid it, kept it, and then tried to return it. But that's not how it works. We have to be working on the talents that we have. We have to be putting effort into the opportunities that God gives before us. And, you know, as it says here, some have more opportunities than others. God doesn't judge in kind of an absolute comparison. It's based off of what we do with what we have. And those who have more are going to be judged more strictly. Those who have less are going to be judged on what they do with what they have. So it's a very fair situation that God has put us in. But the requirement for all of us is that we are pushing ourselves and we're growing and we're improving and we're willing to work hard at what we need to do. This is one of those things that's valuable in our Christian life and in our development, but it's also incredibly valuable in the real world as well. The most valuable employees are the ones who are self-starters, who push themselves, who have drive and resourcefulness, the ones who find out what needs to be done and then get on that without having to have constant direction and supervision, you know, the ones who are diligent about doing it the right way. That will make us valuable in our jobs. That will make us valuable in the kingdom. So be motivated, stay motivated, work hard. The next rule, 5, pursue wisdom. Pursue wisdom. 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3, and we'll start in verse 7. God appears to Solomon in a dream here and says, Ask whatever you want. 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 7, And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of David my father, and I am but a little child. I know not how to go out or come in, and your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great people that cannot be numbered nor counted for multitude. Give therefore your servant an understanding heart, to judge your people, that I may discern between good and bad, for who is able to judge this, your so great a people? And the speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. Now, if we look at what Solomon says here, this applies directly to us. God made Solomon king, and he was king over a multitude of people, so many people that it was hard to even count them. And that's what we have in our future. If we stick with it, we can make it all the way into the kingdom. If we're going to rule for 1,000 years, God is going to make us kings. He's going to make us kings over all of the people on earth, which will be billions and billions of people. And so that's not something that we can do with the knowledge that we have as humans. We need God to give us wisdom. We need an understanding heart. We need to be able to have discernment. We need to be developing all of that now. Of course, once we're spirit beings, then we will have all of that in spades. But that's something that we can be working on now and asking God the same prayer, asking him to help us to develop all of that. And Solomon became the wisest king that ever ruled, and he wrote a book of wisdom. How convenient for us. Let's turn over to Proverbs chapter 8. We'd like to be preparing to be wise kings, and we have this book of Proverbs that Solomon wrote and collected, where we can learn directly from the wisest ruler that ever ruled. Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 16. In Proverbs 8, wisdom is personified here, and wisdom is speaking in first person. Proverbs chapter 8 and verse 16. By me princes rule and nobles, even all the judges of the earth. I love them that love me, and those that seek me early shall find me. So I said that the rule is to pursue wisdom. You know, we can ask God to give us wisdom, but then what it says here in verse 17, those that seek me early shall find me. We have a part to do in it as well. We should go out and be trying to acquire real wisdom. And you can read Proverbs here, which is a book of wisdom. Read the rest of the Bible. Read other good books. You can study successful leaders and learn from them as well. Go back and compare how they were successful to what the Bible tells us, what we read in the seven laws of success. And you put that all together and you start to seek after wisdom and pursue it, and then you will start to acquire it. A book called Endurance is about Ernest Shackleton. And so Ernest Shackleton was an Antarctic explorer in the early 1900s and took a couple of trips down there and then tried to complete a trans-Antarctic voyage, but was stuck in the ice. His ship became trapped in ice floes. And he started in 1914, and in January of 1915, his ship became trapped. And they were stuck for 10 months, just floating around, stuck in the ice. They were hoping that the ice would break up and that they would be able to continue on their voyage. But instead, what happened is after 10 months, the ice started to crush the ship, and they had to abandon the ship and get out on these ice floes. And eventually, after several weeks, the hull crushed and the ship sank. And here was Shackleton and his crew just basically camping out on a giant chunk of ice floating around Antarctica. It's interesting, you know, the name of their ship was Endurance, and they called their camp Patience Camp because there was nothing for them to do but sit and wait. So they stayed on this ice. Eventually, the ice floe they were on started to break apart. They still had some lifeboats. They hopped in their lifeboats and floated over to Elephant Island. And so from the time that they became stranded to the time that they made it to Elephant Island was about 500 days. So they had survived 500 days, made it to Elephant Island. Elephant Island is not really conducive to living on, though. It's still down there very close to Antarctica, and it's not a comfortable place. There weren't really any inhabitants there, so they were now stranded again on Elephant Island. And so what they then did is they got their sturdiest lifeboat, they reinforced it, they put together a small crew, and they headed out across the ocean 800 miles to whaling stations in South Georgia. They made it to South Georgia, but they were on the opposite side from where all the people were. So then they had to hike across and do this overland trip that had never been done before, and it was 40 years before anyone else was ever able to do it again. They made it to the other side, and they were able to get some help, go back to Elephant Island, and spoiler alert, everyone survived. But it's actually the only Antarctic trip that had an accident like that where everyone survived and where no one went mad, no one went insane from the months and months of darkness that were down there. But obviously, that's a pretty extreme situation. From the time that they were first trapped, January 19th, 1915, to the time that they were all rescued was August 30th, 1916, so 20 months. And they all made it through. And you go through and you see how Shackleton, he had an attitude of service. He gave his clothes. He gave his food. He kept the men together, kept them motivated, and never gave up, and was able to really pull them through that incredible ordeal. And so you can go and you can read about experiences like that. You can read autobiographies, and you can learn a lot and gain a lot of understanding around leadership and applying rulership from a lot of different sources out there. So pursue wisdom and go seek after it. That's one of the rules. The next rule ties right into the story of Shackleton. We have to build patience and endurance if we're going to rule. You know, if Shackleton hadn't had endurance, hadn't had patience, he wouldn't have been able to help his men stick through that. You know, if he had been impatient and given up, the whole expedition would probably have been lost. So we have to build patience and endurance, and we should try to cultivate that in those around us. If we're parents, we should be trying to help our children develop patience and endurance. It's a really valuable character trait to have. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24 and verse 44. We were just talking about this earlier. Matthew 24, verse 44. Therefore be you also ready, for in such an hour as you think not the Son of Man comes. Verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his Lord has made ruler over his household to give them meat in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord when he comes shall find so doing. Verily I say unto you that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. So we have to stick with it. We have to endure. We have to patiently wait for Christ's return. We have to just continue doing the right thing, and that's the one that will be made a ruler. The one who is there, as it says, so doing, verily I say unto you that he shall make him ruler over all his goods. So that's what has to be our focus and where we're putting our energy. Let's turn over to Romans. Romans chapter 2. And to build patience and endurance, you generally don't have to work too hard to find opportunities. We need patience all the time and endurance all the time. I think one of the best ways to build patience and endurance is to fly the commercial airlines. I spent a lot of time earlier this year, I was flying almost every week, and I have a lot of stories of patience and endurance. There was one in particular where I went to New York, and I was flying out of LaGuardia, and you know, there were a group of us who were all flying out, and my flight was actually supposed to leave first, and so I went to the gate, and I kind of waited until most people had boarded, and then I started to get on. And I was the last person in line getting onto the plane. And just as I got onto the plane, I was standing there right inside the door. And the captain was standing at the door of the cockpit talking to the stewardesses. And he said, yeah, I think we're going to have to take them all off. And I was kind of like, what? So I started listening. And the stewardess said, do we want to wait for a little bit or do we want to just unload them all now? And he said, well, I think we're just going to have to unload them all. And so sure enough, you know, they make an announcement and everybody has to get off the plane. So we all get off the plane. There had been some step that they had forgotten to do in a security check of going through and making sure that the plane was completely empty and there wasn't anything on there. So we had to all get off the plane. They do the security check, and then they start the boarding process again. We get back on the plane, and then we were about to depart, and there's some problem, mechanical issue. And so they say, well, we're going to have maintenance come out and check it out. And so we all sit there for about 30 or 40 minutes. And then the captain comes on and says, you know, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to switch planes, so we're all going to have to get off again. And so we all get off the plane again, and they go and pull that plane out, pull another plane up. And, you know, by now we're an hour and a half or 2 hours delayed, and a storm had rolled through while all of this was going on. And so I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, we probably wouldn't have taken off anyway, so it's not that big a deal. And we get on, taxi out. When we get to the point where we kind of line up, you know, I look out the window and I see lots of planes down there. I think, man, that's got to be at least a couple dozen planes that are lined up here to take off. And the pilot comes on and he says, well, you know, it looks like we've got a plane that works and we're all on board. But the bad news is we're number 75 for takeoff. Which I think is the, you know, the highest number I've ever heard. But the weather had backed up all the flights. So no flights had been leaving LaGuardia. And because of our mechanical problems, had basically lost our place in line, and we're at the back of the pack. So he says, you know, we're going to be here for a while. If you want to get on your phones or use your laptops, feel free to. I'll let you know when we need you to turn them off. And so we sit out there. It actually went faster than I expected. They were using as many runways as they could. We get up there, and we're number two for takeoff, and we shut everything down. He's doing pre-flight checks. And all of a sudden, the cockpit bell that they use as a chime to do different signals when you pass 10,000 feet, things like this, it just starts going, bing, 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 bing. And, you know, several of us start looking at each other. And then I notice that instead of pulling onto the runway, we continue down the taxiway and turn around and stop kind of past it. And then the lights flicker, and then the chime goes crazy again, and the pilot comes on and he says, I'm sorry, but we're having electrical problems, and we're actually going to have to go back to the gate. So we turn around, we go back to the gate again, and you know, at this point, there were a lot of people who were getting very frustrated, and the guy beside me was like, oh, I can't believe this, you know, I don't know why we can't get out of here. And I said, I would rather not fly with electrical problems, personally, you know. And that's one of those things that I'd rather stay here and fix it than have to try to make an emergency landing with the plane filled with smoke. And he's kind of like, well, yeah, I guess that's a good point. And so we go back, we sit there, they bring maintenance on, we sit there for another 30 or 40 minutes, and eventually they say, well, you can go ahead and get off the plane, this is going to take a while. So we all get off the plane again, and we're sitting there in the departure area, and this is now, I think it's maybe 4 or 5 hours after I was supposed to leave, and I get an email on my phone that American Airlines had rebooked me on another flight the next morning. And so I saw that, and I was like, I wonder what that means. And sure enough, a couple minutes later, someone comes out and says, sorry, everyone, we've had to cancel this flight. We can't find another plane, and we can't fly this one. And so the flight was canceled, and we were all rebooked on flights the next day. I ended up having to spend another night in New York after spending 5 or 6 hours on and off the plane in the airport. That kind of thing happens, and I'm sure you all have stories of various situations where you had to wait and things just have never kind of gone right. And those are all things that help us build patience. We can either get angry and mad and lose our temper, or we can look at it as an opportunity to build patience. If we want to be rulers, we have to be building patience. All right, the seventh rule, avoid greed and materialism. You need to be generous. Let's go back to Proverbs again. Proverbs chapter 28. This is something that's important for everyone, but especially for rulers. If you're in a position of authority, you can't have an excess of selfish ambition and greed, or it will be your undoing. Proverbs chapter 28 and verse 15. Proverbs 28 verse 15. As a roaring lion and a raging bear, so is a wicked ruler over the poor people. The prince that wants understanding is also a great oppressor. But he that hates covetousness shall prolong his days. So the ruler that hates covetousness is the one that will rule for a long time. If there's a ruler or government official who takes bribes, who is greedy for whatever they can get for themselves, that may work for a while, but eventually that comes tumbling down. It just doesn't work over the long term. And eventually they lose everything they have. We've seen several instances of that in our political system in the past few years, in both political parties and state government and Congress, and it's something that just erodes all of the trust that people have in their leaders. So rulers can't be greedy, we can't be materialistic, we need to be generous. And you have to remember that, again, none of that is really going to matter in the end. None of that is going to have any value. Steve Jobs was a billionaire. I think his net worth was about $8.3 billion, and he's died, and all he's taken with him is the character that he developed. He doesn't get to take any of that $8.3 billion with him. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 19. That can't be our focus. Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19 and verse 21. This is the story of the young man who had come to Christ and asked what he needed to do to have eternal life. Christ had listed out some of the commandments, and the young man had said that he's done all of those. And then in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 21, Jesus says unto him, if you will be perfect, go and sell that you have and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me. But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Then said Jesus unto his disciples, verily I say unto you that a rich man shall hardly enter into the kingdom of heaven. And again I say unto you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. And so the people who are focused on accumulating wealth and doing whatever they have to do to make that happen don't have the attitude to be kings and rulers. This is what it's talking about right here, you know, entering into the kingdom of heaven. They aren't going to be able to have that position, because they don't have that right kind of attitude. The eighth rule is stay loyal. Stay loyal. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 24. 1 Samuel chapter 24 and verse 4. So this is when David was being heavily pursued by Saul. Saul was trying to kill David. And in this case, David and his men were hiding in a cave, and Saul came in there, not knowing that. 1 Samuel 24 and verse 4. And the men of David said unto him, behold the day which the Lord said unto you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hand, and you may do to him as it shall seem good unto you. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privily. And it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt. And he said unto his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. So David did this, and then realized, similar to Paul over in Acts, that yes, Saul is trying to kill me, and Saul hates me, he doesn't take care of me, but he's still God's anointed, he's still in that position, God has put him there, and so I shouldn't even do this insult of cutting off his skirt here. And David goes and talks to Saul, and then down in verse 17, Saul answers him, 1 Samuel 24, verse 17, and he said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have rewarded me good, whereas I have rewarded you evil." You know, Saul knows who David is and knows what David has done. And he said, "You're more righteous than I. You have shown me this loyalty here, even though I haven't returned it to you." Loyalty is truly tested when things are not perfect. If things are easy and things are perfect, then, you know, sure, you can have loyalty. But it's not really loyalty, I don't think. It's easy to be loyal when everything's going great. That's convenient. But when it's not convenient, when it's truly tested, that's when things are not perfect. And that's when you can see if you have that true loyalty. Let's go over to 2 Timothy chapter 2. We should be loyal to our families, loyal to the church, loyal to our leaders, loyal to those who depend on us. We should also be loyal to Christ, be willing to stick with it and stay loyal, even when times are tough. And here in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 12, Paul has a very simple rule here. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 12, "If we suffer, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he also will deny us." So when things get tough and when it's hard to stick with it and to do the right thing, do we suffer and then reign, or do we deny Christ and then lose that opportunity? You know, we have to have that loyalty through those tough times. Rule number 9 for rulers, be just and fair. Let's go to Proverbs 29 again. Justice, fairness, those are requirements. It's kind of the other side of greed, covetousness. Proverbs chapter 29 and verse 2. Proverbs 29 verse 2, "When the righteous are in authority, the people rejoice, but when the wicked bears rule, the people mourn." And yes, when there's a corrupt person in office, the corrupt people may be doing well and they may rejoice. But the righteous people, you may have had a boss who played favorites, who picked on you, who was not righteous. And I'm sure that you could understand this verse. And then you may have had a boss who really cared for you, who looked out for you, who stood up for you and was loyal. And, you know, that's the kind of boss where you can rejoice and you can be very happy in that situation. That's the kind of rulers that we're going to have to be. Let's go down to verse 12 as well. "If a ruler hearken to lies, all his servants are wicked." And there are two ways that that becomes true. If a ruler hearkens to lies, if he listens to gossip and lies and acts on it, then what happens is those who stand for the truth are not going to be part of his administration anymore. They're going to leave. They're not going to stay there. And the ones who stay are going to see that, oh, you know, the way to get ahead here is to lie, you know, to cheat, to steal, to basically, you know, fall in line with the way that he wants to run this. And sooner or later, all of his servants will be wicked. The ones who aren't wicked will leave, and the ones who are there are going to take advantage of it. And so a ruler has to be just, has to be fair, and has to put a high premium on everyone around him being just and fair. And that's how we're going to administer God's government as well. Let's turn back just a few pages to Proverbs chapter 21. Proverbs chapter 21. Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 3. "To do justice and judgment is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice." So that's where God puts his premium. God doesn't listen to lies. God's not that kind of ruler. He puts a premium on justice, judgment, righteousness. That's more acceptable than sacrifice. If we are trying to give a big offering and then go and do whatever we want to do, that's basically a bribe. You can't bribe God. You can't bribe God with a sacrifice. He wants justice and judgment. Micah 6:8 says, "He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God." So it's all about being just and fair and, you know, following that path. Rule number 10, correct mistakes quickly. As humans, we're going to make mistakes. We're going to make lots of mistakes. When you make a mistake, you need to correct it. You need to turn it around and correct it. Let's go back to 2 Samuel and look at another story from David's life here. 2 Samuel chapter 6. We were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, I think. The Philistines had the ark and it was causing all sorts of problems for them, so they sent it back to Israel, and David wanted to bring it to Jerusalem. So he gathered a big group of people, they built a cart, and they put the ark on the cart, started to try to bring it to Jerusalem. We can pick up the story here, 1 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 3. They set the ark of God upon a new cart, brought it out of the house of Abinadab that was in Gibeah, and Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, drave the new cart. So these were just sons of this man who was living in Gibeah where the ark had just kind of ended up when the Philistines sent it back. And they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was at Gibeah, accompanying the ark of God, and Ahio went before the ark. And David and all the house of Israel played before the Lord on all manner of instruments made of fir wood, even on harps and psalteries, timbrels, cornets, cymbals. And when they came to Nathan's threshing floor, Uzzah put forth his hand to the ark of God, took hold of it, for the oxen shook it. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and God smote him there for his error, and there he died by the ark of God. And David was displeased because the Lord had made a breach upon Uzzah, and he called the name of the place Perez Uzzah to this day. So the ark ended up, you know, they just left it there, and they didn't bring it back. And this is a story, I gave a sermonette on this a while ago, but it's one of those things where, oh, you know, Uzzah was just trying to save the ark. But from the beginning, they were doing this in the wrong way. And David realized this. If we turn over to 1 Chronicles chapter 15, we can see how he corrects it. He doesn't go back and make the same mistake again and try to load it up on another cart and bring it. He realizes that he made a mistake, and he fixes it, and they are able to bring the ark back. 1 Chronicles chapter 15 and verse 2. Then David said, "None ought to carry the ark of God but the Levites. For them has the Lord chosen to carry the ark of God and to minister unto him forever." And verse 3. And David gathered all Israel together to Jerusalem to bring up the ark of the Lord unto his place, which he had prepared for it. And David assembled the children of Aaron and the Levites, of the sons of Kohath, Uriel the chief, and his brethren, 120. If you go back to Exodus chapter 6, you'll see that the sons of Kohath were the ones that were specifically designated from the Levites to carry the ark. They were supposed to carry it on their shoulders. And you can see David's conclusion down in verse 12, 1 Chronicles 15, 12. And said unto them, "You are the chief of the fathers of the Levites. Sanctify yourselves, both you and your brethren, that you may bring up the ark of the Lord God of Israel unto the place that I have prepared for it." Verse 13, "For because you did it not at the first, the Lord our God made a breach upon us, for that we sought him not after the due order." You know, he had made a mistake. They didn't do this the right way. And so, you know, they had to deal with the consequences that came from these wrong actions. But after this, they were able to bring it up and correct it, and David had fixed his mistake. You see that David's someone who has a lot of his mistakes recorded, but you'll notice that he always repented and changed and fixed it. And he was still one of the best examples of a ruler that we have in the Bible. Let's go back to 2 Samuel chapter 6. So the 10th rule is correct mistakes quickly. The 11th rule is do the right thing even if it's not popular. Do the right thing even if it's not popular. Too many times rulers, they rule as if it's all a popularity contest rather than realizing that they have a responsibility that comes along with the authority to do the right thing. They often get caught up in trying to do the popular thing. 2 Samuel chapter 6. After they're able to bring it up, David is celebrating here in verse 20. Then David returned to bless his household, and Michal, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David and said, "How glorious was the king of Israel today, who uncovered himself today in the eyes of the handmaids of his servants, as one of the vain fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." So David had been dancing and rejoicing as they brought the ark back. Verse 21, "And David said unto Michal, It was before the Lord, which chose me before your father and before all his house, to appoint me ruler over the people of the Lord of Israel. therefore will I play before the Lord. So David was rejoicing, and he was just ecstatic that they were able to bring the ark back. And Michael came out and was basically making fun of him and saying, oh, yeah, you know, look at you. You're so royal, and you're out here embarrassing yourself in front of everyone. But David didn't let that bother him, because he knew that he was doing it before God. He was doing it in the right attitude, and he wasn't going to let that get to him. And sometimes, we have to put up with people who pick on us or make fun of us, or they give us a hard time for the things that we do, the things that we believe. And we have to just brush that off and realize, if we're doing the right thing, it doesn't matter what other people are saying or what kind of a hard time they're giving us. Let's go over to Acts chapter 5. Something that the apostles faced on even more serious matters. Acts chapter 5 and verse 27. They had gone out preaching, started to upset the authorities who were in power. Acts chapter 5 and verse 27. And when they had brought them, they set them before the council, and the high priest asked them, saying, did we not straitly command you that you should not teach in this name? And behold, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood upon us. It says, didn't we tell you not to do this? Verse 29, then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. And they were doing this under the threat of jail and death, and most of them ended up being martyred. But they were determined to do the right thing, even if it was unpopular or dangerous, they were going to stick with it and do the right thing. All right, rule 12, we made it. Rule number 12, exercise faith. Exercise faith. Let's go to Matthew chapter 8. Matthew chapter 8 and verse 5. Matthew 8 verse 5, when Jesus was entered into Capernaum, there came unto him a centurion, beseeching him and saying, Lord, my servant lies at home sick of the palsy, grievously tormented. And Jesus said unto him, I will come and heal him. The centurion answered and said, Lord, I am not worthy that you should come under my roof, but speak the word only, and my servant shall be healed. For I am a man under authority, having soldiers under me, and I say to this man, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. So this was someone who was a ruler over soldiers, and he understood how authority worked, and he knew that Christ had authority. And so he said, you don't have to come to heal. And it's really interesting to see Christ's response here, verse 10. When Jesus heard it, he marveled and said to them that followed, verily I say unto you, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. And if you go over to the next chapter, you'll see a story where there's a ruler of a synagogue, and he came and actually had asked Christ to come to perform a healing in his house. And so that's the kind of faith that we need to have. We don't see Christ. It's not someone who walks around now. We don't see him like the apostles saw him, but he still has the same power, and we still have to have the same kind of faith as this centurion and others had. Let's turn to James chapter 2. If you'll notice, rule 12 was exercise faith. James chapter 2. Verse 18. James 2, verse 18. Yea, a man may say, you have faith, and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. If we truly have faith, it impacts what we do. It impacts our works. It changes the things that we go out and do. And you can't just have faith. We have to exercise it. We have to use it, and we have to let it impact how we live our lives. I was training. I wanted to run a half marathon. And so I was training and exercising and starting to build up muscle, and then I got an injury. And at the point that I got the injury, I had muscle, but I stopped exercising, and now I don't have as much muscle. You can have faith, but if you don't exercise it, it'll atrophy and it'll go away, and you'll get to the point where, you don't have faith. You had faith, but you stopped exercising it, and it's just like anything else. You have to use it. You have to put it into practice. And you have to not just say, oh, well, I've got faith, I'm fine. And you have to be using it, you have to be exercising it. So that's the 12th rule, is exercise faith. So that's a lot of points, and each of those could have a lot more detail around them. Each of them could probably be a sermon on its own. There's a lot more to dig into as you go through and you look at all the aspects of the kind of character that we're supposed to be building. These 12 points are a start, at least. And if we work on following these rules, building this kind of character, then we'll see improvements in our lives now, improvements in our relationships, improvements in our abilities and our attitudes, but more importantly, we'll make progress in developing that one critical element that will determine our future, and that's character to rule.